Hey, this is Robert Rodriguez.
And Jason Latour, and you're listening to The Amazing Spider Talk.
Welcome to The Amazing Spider Talk. My name is Dan Gavazdin, and I'm the editor of SuperiorSpiderTalk.com.
And I'm Mark Cianacchio, the editor of the Chasing Amazing blog.
Thanks for joining us for our newest special episode of Spider Talk and their amazing friends.
Yeah, this is exciting, right, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Mark, who do we have on the show today?
Yeah, well, we have some pretty amazing friends. I would say that, face it, Tiger, we hit the jackpot with these two. Yeah, you know, we have to work that joke in at least a dozen times, I think, for this interview. We have spoken with the creative duo behind Edge of Spider-Verse number 2, Spider-Woman, a.k.a. Spider-Gwen, Jason Latour and Robbie Rodriguez. So we're going to talk a little bit about the phenomena that is Spider-Gwen right now. This character is really taken over, it seems like, right, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even before the book came out, there was all this buzz about it.
Yeah, and you know, I think, you know, we haven't done a straight up review of the book yet, but you know, I think we both are in agreement that it was a pretty cool introduction to this character. So, you know, we hope you all enjoy what we got here, and we hope that we do in fact hit the jackpot with this interview.
And as with all of our shows, if you hear this sound, please check out your iOS device for a link to an article, video, or image to enhance your listening experience. Well, let's get right into it and continue our conversation with Jason and Robbie.
Dan, well, here we are with Jason Latour. Say hi, Jason.
Hi, Jason.
And Robbie Rodriguez.
Hi, Robbie.
And they are the creative duo behind Edge of Spider-Verse number 2, the Gwen Stacy Spider-Woman, or Spider-Gwen, as people seem to be calling it. And we're very thankful you guys are here. And, you know, I thought in talking about this comic that actually we would start at the very, very end, since, you know, this comic came out a week ago as we're recording this. And, you know, the reaction to this thing has just been overwhelmingly positive. You know, you got people calling for an ongoing. You have the Married with Sea Monsters doing a cover of Mary Jane's Face It Tiger song. I mean, could you guys have ever predicted that this reaction to this comic?
Let's go with Jason first on that.
No. Well, paying attention to the internet, like it did seem as if there was some sort of groundswell moving around the character design and the character, just the concept of the story. So I wasn't completely unprepared for people's reaction. I am a little surprised that people have loved it as much as they have, just because, you know, you write monthly comics for a living, and you really can't predict what people are gonna react to. You know, every time I send in a script, I generally feel pretty good about it. There's times when you
think like, oh, I wish I had a couple more days, or you know, conversely, there's times where you feel like you nailed it, and generally, like you learn pretty quickly that like you can't predict how an audience is going to receive a thing, so you kind of have to write it for you and for the creative team as much as possible. So in that regard, like, I felt good about it when I left my desk, and I felt even better about it when Robbie and Rico's pages started coming in. But just being a one-shot sort of, I didn't expect it to have as much traction as it's gotten. But I was hopeful for that traction, because I know we both, all three of us, and Niccolo, our editor, all really, really enjoyed working on it. I can't speak for Robbie, but I know it was very exciting to like watch like a community start to grow around this character, like even before the issue was out. So it was really gratifying, like that people have seemed to enjoy what we did, and that it really lived up to these sort of, well, I'm hopefully it worked, lived up to these sort of, you know, huge expectations.
Yeah, we're like, I had expectations about it, but I didn't realize how big it was going to be in general. So I knew we had something cool in general once me and Jason started talking about it quite a bit. And I knew we had like lightning in a bottle. And I didn't realize that once we cracked that bottle, how huge it broke out at that time. So it was just a matter of just, because I knew it was like, and part of it, like, even like, it was inside baseball. I don't mind saying this, like, the whole, like, the whole like song with it, that was my idea too, just to market it as a guerrilla way with it in general.
I think Robbie knew the Married with Sea Monsters people. He's done a lot. They're like friends of his, so he's done a lot of stuff with them in the past. And I think, did you show them like the preview pages and they just got excited about it?
Well, I showed a few pages, and then I was telling the concept with it, and then the whole thing was like, I commissioned them the whole song because I wanted much like we learned from Wolverine, it's kind of like I just kept you away from this, so you have like enough deniability. It's like, oh, I have nothing to do with this in general.
Well, that's not an issue. I do think it was really cool that that all came together the way it did. Yeah, like
it is, but that was part of the whole like me self-marketing it on this book in general, because we have one shot with this, and you know, we were talking before, like I just left FEP and I got tired of, you know, I really want to push push the limits of what I can doing with the big two. So it's got a point, like, all right, so I'm going to, and I told Jason before, it was like one drunken night. I was walking home from a bar drunken night. I texted him real quick. He's like, hey, Jason, I'm going to do a fucking song with Mary Sea Monsters. And I think he'd kind of pass it off for a bit. But to me, like, for me to push the project to feel just not just as a corporate gig and feel something personal, if I can market it as something of my own. And that's what the whole thing would do, the Sea Monster thing, and extreme this project as my own entity, and then it became just an entity between Jason and Rico and us. It's like pure, like, it's just an entire f-ing project that we feel personal about, that pushes our personal limits about it with it, and that's the entire thing I want to push it with it. And that's the whole thing behind the entire guerrilla marketing with it. It's like not just the costume design, and I kept doing the Instagram stuff, just keep posting as far as like over and over again as I'm working on the project in general. And that was the whole end of my quasi-way guerrilla marketing for this book. And honestly, it kind of connected with it. It connected with the audience, connected with a generation that's probably like 15 years behind me, but I still connected with them, and it kind of caught on.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you mention, you know, kind of these guerrilla marketing efforts, because I, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you two about is, I mean, you both work on creator-owned projects, so to kind of transition to this, you know, to one of the big two, even though it's kind of this like standalone, isolated, you know, property here. I mean, you know, this was you know, designed to be a one-shot. I mean, whether it'll evolve into something bigger, we'll see. So like, how was that in terms of your process? I mean, you know, beyond the song, I mean, were there other things that that you did, that you, how you approached the story differently? I mean, in terms of, you know, creatively or marketing or whatever, that, you know, that you were able to kind of borrow from your from what you've been doing on the independent scene?
I knew from the start that I really that this project had to like count on its own. The idea of Gwen Stacy coming back was for me a thing that when I grew up, that was a cardinal rule. That was a thing that you weren't supposed to do. You weren't supposed to bring Gwen Stacy back. So I knew that on some level that that was stacked against us. And the other side of it was, is that, you know, it's essentially a what if story. Those are two things that in traditional, like, sort of comic book thinking, you're not supposed to really care about. But I knew the only way to make people care about it was to sort of give it our all and to sort of try and put a team together that I felt like would do that. So, you know, when Robbie's talking about, like, investing 110% into something, I think that's absolutely what we tried to do. The benefit of, like, working at on an image or a creator-owned book is that I think a lot of times those things stand out because the teams have a nice working history and feel more hand in glove. And I knew with Robbie and Rico that those are two guys that I've known for such a long time that that we would have a much better chance of succeeding and a much better chance of really putting something worth reading onto the paper and not like having it just be sort of a disposable what if Gwen Stacy story.
So how did you guys get connected with this project? You know, Dan Slott has said that he's had very little to do with the Edge of the Spider-Verse titles. So did you pitch this idea, or did someone at Marvel come to you guys about it?
It was sort of a combination of things. As I said, you know, like Gwen Stacy was an idea that I don't think bringing back Gwen Stacy was an idea that when I was a kid was a thing that like you were supposed to not do, you know? So when Nick first initially started talking to me about it, he mentioned it a couple of times. And I had this other idea that I was really in love with, which was sort of Uncle Ben and Peter Parker together as Spider-Man.
I think we're going to do like a follow-up with that, with our Spider-Man with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they had, and they really liked that, but there was something like that possibly coming down the pipe. And Nick kept mentioning, he had mentioned it twice in passing. And then one day I just called him up and I said, you know, that Spider, that Gwen Stacy character, is that still up for grabs? Because I think I really want to do that story. But I think if I do that story, like, that's such a loaded kind of thing that I really would want to make sure I have the right artist and the right colorist on it, because I would really want this to feel modern and feel like a thing that exists in the zeitgeist that, you know, and affects people who like Gwen Stacy or want Gwen Stacy to be more than a plot point now. I don't want it to feel like a disposable what if story, you know?
I mean, and when you were thinking with the Gwen character, I mean, were you leaning on more her character from the comics or what we've been getting from Emma Stone in the movies, or just total blank slate and just doing your own thing with it?
Well, for my part, and I'll answer first because I think a lot of where I started sort of hopefully informed where Robbie was going with it.
We have two like different like aspects that come to it that kind of combine in general. So, but go ahead and go, Jason.
It was important to me. There were two things that were really important to me about the story. And one was, I think that there's a whole generation of people who I'm not here to make the case for or against the death of Gwen Stacy, but I think there's a whole lot of people who have grown up or have recently come to Spider-Man comics that death is not so easy to swallow. If you're even of my age, Gwen Stacy was always just sort of a plot point. And I knew that going into the project, and so I really felt like it was important that she be a character that stand on her own two feet, have her own personality, and is her own character independent of Peter Parker. But I also knew that, like, the theme of the story was how does the Spider-Man mythos impact, like, alternate reality characters or different versions of Spider-Man? How does, like, being Spider-Man hold up in a different universe, you know? So it was as simple as, like, sitting back and thinking about, like, the original conceit of Gwen Stacy being a girl that went to school with Peter Parker and had her own family life, her father that was a police captain, had all these things going on in her life that were different than Peter Parker's. What's the common bond, like, once you become Spider-Man? So it was really, like, kind of a twofold thing. I approached it the same way that I would approach, like, any new character. I just happened to have sort of a set of parameters that, you know, could kind of fence in the ideas and focus them, if that makes any sense. And from there, you know, it was like the second part of the, or the third part of the project was, or same page with Robbie. And one of the things that we really wanted to do visually with the book was make it feel new, but also, like, to treat Spider-Woman with the same sort of mystery or edge that, like, the original, like, Spider-Man Ditko stuff had, where Spider-Man, you know, was a masked character that you don't really isn't easily recognized. You know, isn't every other Spider-Woman character has been sort of recognizable by their ponytail and their, you know, the aspects that make them feminine. And I really felt like it was important that we keep her just as interesting visually as Spider-Man was.
So going off of that, Robbie, you know, what's your process like for developing a character's costume or design?
The character's that was basically just me. I just want to make something so different, that was an aspect different, completely different, like the Spider-Man mythos. Because me and Jason talked about, for like Jason, we had a conversation before where, like, I'm not the biggest superhero fan in general. And when they said they wanted to do Spider-Woman, like, things, I told Nick before emails, like, I'm not drawing that f-ing costume in general. I'm redesigning it.
You so mean it's Drew costume.
The Jess Drew costume. Yes, I'm not fucking doing that fucking costume. Yeah, like, I've seen super costumes, like, a lot of stuff needs to, these hip quite a bit up, and going there is, like, just looking at, like, the cosplay elements and just the recent, like, Japanese elements of, like, fashion and whatnot, and European fashion, what I want to imply some of that, and even though in the back of my head, it's kind of like, as I was designing the costume, it's like, oh, God, what if Corey Walker had a chance to redesign Spider-Woman, what would he do? That was the entire aspect to me when I was doing that costume. But in order for just, but part of it is just add more of an urban element to it. And also add the, as Jason talked before, like, I wanted to bring a more dimension of what someone who would be in a costume, what would they actually wear into it? And that's why, and that's what pulled the entire dimensions essentially with it. And early on, like, me and Jason were talking, we were, like, throwing up designs for, like, a good 2 days about the costume. And, like, it was kind of whack for a bit. And then all of a sudden, it's like, one day I just kind of threw it up there. And it's like, I think I got it at that point. And it was just more thinking of a point where, in a way, it's kind of like, it's every ex-girlfriend I've had and every female friend I've had, girlfriend I've had, but female friend, girlfriend, I was like, if they were a superhero, this is what they wear. And that's what f-ing locked that in at that point.
Yeah, a lot of what I felt like Robbie really achieved with that was, like he said, like, trying to come up with something striking that sort of stood as its own. I think, I don't know, just to my eye, a lot of characters that are second or third generation versions of existing heroes, like, they end up sort of copying the motif of the other characters to a fault. So, you know, like my, I don't know how you guys feel. You guys are bigger Spider-Man fans maybe than anybody here. But like me, I grew up with the black costume, you know?
Yeah.
But to me, I've always been a big fan of the black, the simplicity of the black and white costume. And one of the reasons why I think that costume works so well is because it adheres to the basic concept of Spider-Man, but also, you know, is a very striking and design-driven costume.
Yeah, it's kind of, I can't imagine what a Steve Ditko was 30 in the f***ing year 2000, and he designed a costume. That'll see, like, another mindset with it when I was designing it.
Yeah, and again, you know, like the choice to cover her face and cover her head, I think, are a big deal. You know, to whatever degree, like, women in the Spider universe are generally, their defining characteristic visually is that they are women, you know. And with this, you know, I knew Robbie could pull off making her a girl that has personality and life. And so the issue was, like, how does she stand on her own as a superhero?
Yeah, this design for this character came out almost like the same time that Spider-Woman cover came out. And it was like this striking, you know, difference between the two designs for, you know, the way that women are portrayed in comic books. So I was really thankful to see your guys' design.
Thanks, man. Well, you know, and you also have to keep in mind, like, I don't know, like, a pet peeve of mine is like, over-sexualization in general is kind of problematic, but it's a real problem for me when it's teenage girls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and we're dealing with a character that's probably 19 or 20, you know, like, at the oldest. She's very early in college. So it just felt like most of the cliches or tropes that things that come become problematic in stories about female superheroes are that you always emphasize on their sexuality or their love life or, you know. And I felt like on every angle, we wanted this character to stand on its own and have the same kind of problems and presentation that Spider-Man might have if he were new in 2014, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty much essentially like, you know, even though it is a proper gag, pretty much kind of treat her as our own, like, create our own character, pretty much, with this thing.
So
it's pretty much, it's our own, like, it's our, to me, Jason, it's like, it's our own voice on this character.
So who's Robbie? I'm guessing it was your idea to set this in kind of a, like, pseudo punk rock universe.
As a quasi, a little bit like Jason. Well, like he brought the idea of doing the band stuff.
Yeah, well, I knew what Robbie was into. I've known Robbie for 10 years, you know, and it just seemed to me like you want to give a character something that's interesting about him and is also mimics the struggle that being a superhero is, and like that being a superhero has. And it seemed to me like music was sort of an unexplored one. And being a creative person, Robbie keeps talking about having like an investment level. And I just knew, like, you know, a lot of the things that you would deal with as being in a rock band are no different than being a comic book artist.
Yeah, we always bring the analogy together. It's like when you're doing collaborative comics, like it's like being in a band.
Yeah, like, it is very much like being in a band.
Like it got to the point, like some guys just have to play rhythm, and then like some guys, like one point the writer has to be the front man, and then there's a point where the artist has to go like, oh, like this time I'm a solo right now, and then pull back a bit, and then after a bit I'm gonna play rhythm, and then the front man takes over for a bit.
Right. It's so go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's very like back and forth with it.
Yeah, so in some ways, you know, it was the idea of like giving Robbie things that I knew he'd be interested in drawing and staying invested in, but also like it was it seemed to click pretty easily right away. The idea that like you have a character torn between what they want and what they should do and what they want. I think that's always a interesting struggle. And I also liked the idea that since her father is a pretty much a conservative police captain, I liked the idea that it was very much a conflict with her dad, but also made her dad less cliche if he had raised this daughter that he is actually supportive of her musical talent. Mm. It's just the little things I felt like, because I think that's like a much more human interaction. I think a lot of times you would set that up. You would set up the idea that, like, if your father is this conservative lawman, that he would probably be, you know, be like footloose. You can't.
Yeah. I mean, I love that beat where, you know, she's, you know, running late and he's just like, oh, you're late to your own show, Gwen. Like, it was just like this little throwaway beat that I thought, I don't know, that made me really like the Captain Stacy character, you know, in terms of his reaction.
I have conservative parents and I'm a liberal, mostly liberal guy. And I'm an artist, obviously. So yeah. Like, and I know Robbie's from Texas, so he's probably dealt with a lot of the same sort of stuff.
Yeah, we have the same kind of background in general, so we understand where we come from in general with that. Conservative parents, and then dealing with artists. Like, even then, my parents still don't understand what the f*** I'm doing in my life.
And so, if you extrapolate that to the idea of being a superhero, I think that's a very common, you know, like experience. Like that, if you have. A lot of people that read comics at least have some sort of artistic leaning or some sort of interest in art. And I think if you extrapolate that to the idea that you have to sort of like live internally, what would you do if you could put on a mask and, you know, be yourself? So to me, like the idea of her being a drummer in a band is that like, one, we get to see those two things sort of on stage. Literally, and two, we have this idea of like, what does the mask do for her personality, and what does the power set, you know, being a superhero mean to her own ambitions and her own life away from being that kind of thing. To sort of put a point on it, I was going to say that I think a lot of times when people try to do new takes on superheroes, they forget that, especially with solo characters, that these characters have to have personal lives and they have to have struggles within their own lives that reflect what's going on as a superhero. At the end of the day, like to me, the power of being a superhero is that it's kind of a metaphor, you know, or a larger examination of something that goes on in your day-to-day life. So all that sort of stemmed from, you know, the two-pronged attack of like, what is Robbie going to be invested in and what is most interesting on the page? And then I guess it would be a third tier to that idea, which is like, you know, what's something we haven't seen before? What's something different than just being a scientist, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I say with the especially Marvel Comics. It's like, all right, this attack doesn't like what haven't been seen before in a Marvel Comics in like the last 10 years. There's a lot of that aspect with this book. And that's what. The huge aspect was Rico coming in just with the color part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rico was essential.
Yeah. You've not seen that in the, like, in that color palette, you've not seen that in a Marvel comic, like, I guess even in the last 5 years. Yeah. Especially the last tail end, because I finally saw a print version of the book. The entire thing looks like a flyer for a band.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely did not want to do a comic about a rock band and then have it, you know, come out looking like anything less than a cool music video. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of coloring techniques that like could have been applied to this comic that would have really just killed the whole vibe of it. And you know, Robbie and I have both worked pretty hand in hand with Rico over the years, so I knew like we both knew that was the perfect guy, you know, and Nick Lowe. You know, God bless him for having the foresight to agree, you know.
And then it also held that Rico was actually in a real band. Like, no doubt you used to open up for him. And like, early on in his career.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Speaking of music, you know, when I read this comic, and as soon as I opened it and saw the band, I was like, I need to put some music on while I read this. And I'm wondering, like, is there music that you listen to while, like coming up with the rhythm for the way this comic reads? I mean, it's very rhythmic, you know. How do you feel like you achieved that in both like the writing and the art?
I didn't really have a specific soundtrack in my head. Tonally, before. I kept thinking for some reason I did keep thinking of the Pixies a lot for some reason.
Yeah, you did. All sitting here for fucking Pixies. It's not the fucking Pixies the entire time.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter what it is. I think that's the point. I think like the idea is that like if you
that's a good jumping off point for me.
Robbie and I are surely going to bring to it our own versions of what we want.
Yeah.
On page, and I think like if it succeeds, like it has to be a thing that like a kid can pick up or an adult can pick up that's never heard any of these bands, you know. I think kind of the greatest, the common denominator is that like Robbie, Rico, and I all like music. We might not always completely agree on what we like, but we all have enough experience in like sort of being interested in music that we could bring that to the project. In terms of the rhythm of it, like in terms of story beats, it all just sort of clicked together and lined up that, you know, figure out that the story is about a girl who on some was trying to figure out who she is, both in and without, in and outside the costume. Like, where do those two things line up? It felt like there was a real important part of that story where those two things had to sync up for there to be drama. So the rhythm of it is sort of controlled by the fact that there's a 20-page story, at least from a plot standpoint and a story standpoint, that there's 20 pages and you have to sort of build towards a moment. Robbie.
Yeah, so a lot of it's like you can find a lot of my you can find on Spotify on my if you follow it on my Spotify, it's like the music I was playing for this book. Like there's a lot of because Jason brought like the Pixies and it was a good jumping off point. And when I started reading the script quite a bit, it was like, oh, this is not the Pixies. This is a girl rock band, like GRLY. This is like the girl white scene from the 90s, which I love. It's just Bikini Kills, Kathleen Hanna, the entire thing. So from there, I kind of built off from that. And also, I went into it got more like, if you look at the playlist, like it gets more hip hop just to get so I can get the scene back and forth to what the urban city is with it. And that build built a rhythm for that book. Because there are even scenes like me and Jason talked about before that got cut from the book. And there are tracks that had set for the scenes that I cut out from it because it kind of ruined the initial rhythm of the book. So if you go through that, you'll see that it's just all like it goes from like Kathy Hannah to Bratmobile to Mos Def to A Daylight Soul, and then it goes back around to it to like the and it's funny if it, it ends up to like in my playlist it ends up to the Pixies at the very end. Yeah, that playlist.
It's funny. It's also funny because yeah. I think I said Blondie.
honestly, like Gwen is based on Deborah Harry. Those yeah. initial like look was Deborah Harry.
Yeah, just pulled up the script and I said the just as a descriptor, I said yeah. like think of the Pixies if they were Blondie.
Wow. Yeah.
Sorry, you go.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna ask. I mean, kind of in the same vein. I mean, you know, we're talking about like the rhythm that stems from the music, but also, I mean, how did you hit upon the kind of the rhythm of the dialogue of this book? There's a very distinctive sound to how these characters talk. And I mean, the fact that, I mean, you know, we're dealing with teenage or, you know, early 20 women, you know, there was an authenticity to it. And I just was curious, you know, what you were hearing in your head to kind of get that down on a page.
Well, if you ask anybody in my life, they'll tell you that I don't listen ever.
That's why I asked that question.
But my superpower, I think, my secret superpower is that I can talk and listen at the same time.
It depends.
I listen to, you know, I know a lot of women in my real life, you know, and I always joke that, like, you know, I'd much rather talk to women than guys. That, like, I'm a guy's guy that hates guys. No, I don't know. I guess like some of that is just you try to put yourself in the shoes of any character you write, and you try to find, you know, sort of what the, you know, what about it that you identify with, you know. I think it's kind of a mistake to like go down to the arcade and try to replicate what the kids are saying, you know. I can't remember what writer it was, and he's probably a very good writer, but I remember hearing an interview with a writer when I was younger, where he said, like, yeah, I just go down to the arcade and listen to the kids as they play the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And I don't know, you know, you just try to exist in the world enough to have an ear for it. But then, you know, I think really what it comes down to when you're writing a comic book is that, like, a lot of it is controlled. There's a lot of factors that you can't take credit for. You know, one is that, like, you have a very limited amount of space. So everything that you have to have them say has to reveal characters. So if you're, or push the story forward. So, you know, if you really can get yourself in a headspace where you understand the characters, you're just going to be better off in the long run. That way, like, even if you do have a note that's a beat of dialogue that's off a little bit, or, you know, maybe sounds too much like another character or yourself, like, you can weather that storm because you understand, like, what you're writing, you know. It's really just as simple or as complex as you want to make that.
Yeah. And you didn't have to be the creep that hung out at the arcade.
That's right. Yeah. I always joke and say, like, I can't do this. I'm a single mid-30-something guy, so I couldn't do that anyway. I'd look like
George 500 feet.
Yeah, I'd look like George Costanza wanting to play on the plate.
But it's funny you bring it up. That's the argument, like, at the bar with it about that movie Boyhood.
Yeah.
And then going back to this, like, it's like, it's someone like he just understand what he's kind of making up a weird language with these kids, what he thinks what kids are talking about. And like, I've seen that movie in Boyhood. Have you seen that movie yet?
No. That's the Linklater movie.
The Linklater movie, yeah. Oh, it's like terrible. Even when he goes to the 90s, you'll see, it's like, no one's ever said that when you're like in the 90s. And they're like, just because he just haven't understanding what that character or motivation behind that language is going on. When Jason scripts, like, understand what he was going with. And just like the same thing he was saying before, like, most of our friends are female. It's like, I'd rather go hang out with a bunch of girls than any of my guys in general. And just for that, like, just learn seeing that language for the script, that's why I knew we had something at that point. Because, like, all right, he'll give me, like, a certain amount. I was like, I know exactly where Jason's coming from this. I know where he's going to go from this. And, like, I know exactly how to emphasize this to make it better than what Jason actually planned on the script from there.
So Robbie mentioned that there were some deleted scenes. I'm insanely curious. I have to ask, like, what kind of things were left on the writing or drawing room floor?
Oh, the big one is probably there was going to be an Aunt May scene.
Yeah, that was a big one.
Yeah, that's something
which I don't think we should talk about. We should keep that in our back pocket.
I don't want to give that away. I just know that, just would say that there was the Aunt May Gwen Stacy meeting.
I guess a fun one we could say, like, since we're taking that away, it's like a good fun one was the whole, like, Gwen was gonna talk to her dad, and she was gonna kind of walk over in Central Park. She was kind of like, as her dad was dialoguing quite a bit and not paying attention, she was actually gonna walk around a bridge, like, on the side of it, until she realized it, and she like, it's like, oh my god, dad, you don't actually pay attention to me at all.
Yeah.
So you made kind of a vague reference to holding material for later. What is the future of this character? Has they approached you about it? Can you say anything?
There's nothing that we can.
Honestly, there's nothing set. Honestly, we've not heard anything yet.
Yeah, we're hopeful about it. I've had discussions with my editors about it. I know I certainly want to do more of it, and I feel like Robbie does too, and I know Rico does. And I've, you know, just to be prepared.
Yeah, just in case we've talked about it. We have enough stories in our back pocket just in case if something happens.
Yeah, just to be prepared, I've sort of fleshed out, you know, at least a year. So, you know, you don't want to get – when something's this fresh in your head, it can become pretty all-consuming if you let it. So I'm trying to lay down enough track behind the scenes that, you know, were we to pick it up and start running with it, like it won't be – like starting from scratch, but I also want to have it, you know, we both would probably want it to be pretty organic.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, much like this first issue, like this one shot, it was very organic the entire time. Like we treat it as just a organic one shot. Like we just want to do a fun story the entire time. And that's if me and Jason Rico want to do another one, I kind of want, I think we all want to treat it that way. It's a very like it's a very organic entity in itself.
Sure. Are you guys familiar with like the Spider Girl from DeFalco and Friends?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Just curious.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
I always wanted to like it a little bit more than I did, and that's not because that's not really a comment on the quality of it. It's just that I, as a kid, had different tastes. If that book was coming out now, I might love it, you know?
Yeah.
I had pretty trash taste sometimes when I was a kid. but I do like that book sort of set a precedent, you know? I think it's really interesting that you have these sort of alternate reality versions of Spider-Man that sort of work really well, like, conceptually. I mean, speaking for them, not for us. I can't speak about our own book that way. But they, you know, they were conceptually, and they, you know, that book had 100 issues. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Especially given the publishing, the stuff Marvel was publishing at the time. Like, I think it weathered, like, all that Clone Wars stuff and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
100 issues is a long run, and I think you got to kind of tip your hat to that, whether or not you read it or not, you know?
Sure.
I was aware of it. And I always liked the idea of Spider-Man's daughter sort of carrying on the role. So I think, like, it was probably a subconscious influence. You know, I probably would have never put my finger on it unless you, like, brought it up. I do know I wanted to do something, that I wanted us to do something that was different than that. And different than Ultimate Spider-Man, and different than all the other sort of different, but yet not so far removed that it's not Spider-Man, you know?
Yeah.
Sure.
And hopefully we'll get to do more of that, you know? I think, like, it's a really neat era that we're in where, like, the knock on superhero comics used to always be that, like, that they were just like male empowerment issues, and they were about muscles and controlling people and all that kind of stuff. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I always thought that was always the thing people would bandy about. I think it's really interesting that more and more you see, like, these comics become about empowerment of, like, women. I think it adds a whole new flavor and a whole new sort of slant on everything that happens in these books. And it sort of revitalizes a lot of these sort of dusty corners of the Marvel universe or the DC universe or what have you.
Yeah, I think it's not just with, like, empowerment women. It's just more just treating them as just everyone as people.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. We didn't set out to do some, like, sort of, like, grand statement on feminism or you know, or to wave the flag for equality as much as we just tried to do something that was fair and even-handed down the middle, you know, compelling as a story. And I think that's really, like, as three men making a comic about a young girl, that's the only way that we can approach it. It's not really our mission to have, you know?
Yeah, because we can, like, as far as that female empowerment, we can only stretch it so far just as, again, like, as being the three males. We can only, like, understand so much.
But you can produce it in the same way that you would produce any other kind of story. You know, I don't know what it's really like to be a cop, but I have to put myself in the shoes of a cop in order to write a cop and draw a cop. And I think that's the same approach here.
Yeah, at the same time, like, again, with Jason, like, even with, like, Rico, he can attest to this. Like, we've had so many, like empowering female figures in our lives that we can incorporate this into our stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if this is the most empowering question, but bad transition. But I feel like a story like this begs it. So I'm just going to throw this out here: like, Gwen or MJ? And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean Gwen. MJ, you know, yeah.
It's obviously Gwen.
Is that your Marianne question, pretty much?
MJ is really, it's pretty interesting to me, though. Like, I think that, like, that was one of the reasons why we wanted to keep her around, is that I think, like, there is an interesting, like, all these characters gain a new context without Peter. Like, Peter... Like Peter, in these old stories, a lot of the ones that sort of seem to go off track, at least in terms of the women in his life, it starts to become where they're very reactive to him, or put into situations where it only impacts him. I think it becomes completely different. Things gain a new context when he's removed from the picture, and now we're kind of free to explore, like, who Gwen or Mary Jane, Glory or Betty, like, might be without the burden of, like, the meta, the bigger fiction, the external burden of the way people approach Spider-Man. It's more about, like, the reader coming into the project than it is, like, what's going on within the pages, because you can do an interesting Gwen or an interesting Mary Jane or an interesting Glory within, like, a Spider-Man comic very easily, and a lot of people have done, but I think that there's a baggage that a reader brings to a book that has Spider-Man on the cover, you know, that when you remove that, like, you're sort of, you're freed up to do other things.
It's the Bechdel test, the comic book.
No, I wouldn't go that far. I'm just saying, you know, like, you, the fact that he's not in the book anymore means that you can, you know, you can go in a direction that, like, you might not accept with him.
Sure.
You know? That fact that he was the lead means, just by virtue of whether he's a man or not, like, the lead is who the story is supposed to be about.
Sure.
And so, like, now that he's removed, like, you know, the lead is Gwen, and that allows for, like, MJ or the other girls in the band to be developed in a way that they wouldn't necessarily be developed before. I mean, they can be, I was going to say you've removed the romantic side of it, but who knows? You know?
And that's what I think makes it exciting.
Right. I hope so, anyway.
I mean, it's different aspects that we can, like, play around with, the fact that Peter's not a, it's just a factor that, like, we can just, we can actually, like, use these girls as individuals, pretty much, and just deconstruct the characters that people perceive them on, and, you know, like, we're like, all right, let's take this in this direction. Like, we understand the aspects of what MJ is. So, like, all right, she does this and this. Like, let's play with that.
Spider dog behind you?
Yeah.
That's spider dog. Yeah.
We're going to do that book, too.
Yeah.
We need, like, a Scooby-Doo version of Spider-Man.
I don't even know if that's been done necessarily.
Yeah, I should have pitched that.
I know, we were talking earlier. It's like, just don't worry about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, if people read, you know, these people who read Spider-Man comics read your work here and were turned on by your writing and your artwork, where can we find more of your guys' work if people want to check more of you at?
Go ahead, Robbie.
You can find me at frankiegetyourgun.com, and you can just follow me at Twitter on robbyrodriguez.com.
Yeah, I'm on everything. I'm on, like, even, like, Hot or Not and stuff.
Yeah. you can find me on Adult Friend Finder.
Jewish singles.
J-Date, AstroMadison.com. Yeah. I'm on everything. Any social media aspect, you can find me.
Yeah. Yeah, Jason, are you in the Hot or Not column?
I think I'm in the, I vote for Hot. Like, I've loaded my own. I go and vote for myself, like, every hour on the hour. No, you can find me. Just Google my name, or my name. You know, I'm Jason Latour on everything.
What a prick. Like, just Google me.
Well, that's the easiest the rest. Way. You know, like, I'm on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and all that stuff just under my name, Jason Latour.
What about your guys' creative works?
I do my webcom Freaking Get Your Gun, but honestly, you guys should go pick up Southern Bastards with Jason and Aaron.
Thanks, man. Yeah, that's what I'm working on. Me and Jason Aaron are doing a book that is completely different than Spider-Man. Yeah. It's about old rednecks beating each other up with sticks.
Also, if you get if
that's
you can
the Bechdel test.
Yeah, that's the Bechdel test. Go find Loose Ends also by Jason and Chris Bruner and Rico.
Thanks, man.
Great.
And yeah, and Robbie just did FBP. So, like, while we're, you know, throwing out a mutual love fest there, like, they just did 2 volumes FBP, and it's really great stuff from him and Rico there.
Awesome. And maybe rednecks beating each other up is in Gwen's future, too.
You never.
Yeah, we could. Yeah, you never know.
Actually, that's not a bad idea.
Well, what's the character from the Jerry Conway Spectacular run? Banjo, right?
Yes.
Jason Aaron was here this weekend for a signing, and he bought me like he was flipping through the back issues, and he bought me an issue of Spider-Man with with a Razorback in it, because he knows how much I love Razorback.
That is so funny, because I just wrote an article about Razorback on my site this week, because I love Razorback too.
Yeah, I think he's ridiculous, but I love him.
No, you have no idea how much Jason loves Razorback. We've been trying to figure out a story with Razorback for the longest time.
If it's not Razorback or Stegron, you won't find me near it.
Oh, yeah. I just love that his mutant power is he can drive.
But now he doesn't have that power, so he's just a strong dude.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll see Razorback in some Spider-Gwen if we get to come back to it.
if that's a pitch, you know, I've never heard a good pitch before, but that's a pitch.
Yeah.
Man.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, guys.
Yeah, no sweat, man. Thanks for having us.
Awesome. Well, we hope to have you on again real soon to talk more Spider-Gwen, maybe.
Yeah, hopefully.
So. Cool.
Thanks, guys.
So, yeah, thanks again to Jason and Robbie for coming on the show. That was a lot of fun and you know, truly, truly lives up to the name of Spider-Tuck and their amazing friends. Right, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. Two great guys coming on our show. Nothing better than that.
Yeah. We're living the dream, Dan. This is what it's all about.
I really hope that we get to see more Spider-Gwen in the future.
Absolutely. Well, we have to wait till what? Amazing Spider-Man number 9 at this point?
Yeah. That's when she's coming back. But not written by them, written by Dan Slott. So we'll see how the character is handled.
Absolutely. So where can we find the rest of our podcast, Dan?
Well, of course, you can find all of our new Amazing Spider-Talk and old Superior Spider-Talk podcasts at SuperiorSpiderTalk.com, or find us on iTunes by searching Amazing Spider-Talk. And if you do, please leave us a rating and comment and let us know how we're doing, and we'll read it on the air. And if you have any opinions about Spider-Gwen or any questions, please make sure to email them to us at AmazingSpiderTalk@gmail.com, and we'll address and read them on the air.
Yeah, and also be sure to check out both of our Facebook pages at Facebook.com/SuperiorSpiderTalk and Facebook.com/ChaseAndAmazing, because they're pretty cool places to keep up with us in between shows. You know, we put up the articles, Dan gives away codes. I'm kind of being cheap about that for free comics, but, you know, maybe I'll change my mind. So, go to Facebook and you can see if I change my mind.
You can do it, Mark. I have faith in you.
I appreciate that. Well, maybe I'd be more incentivized if we had more people who checked out our friendly neighborhood Spider Talk Members Club. That is the members club where if you donate some of your hard-earned cash, and we give you free comic codes, we might actually do some listener request episodes. Don't forget to check out the most recent listener request episode that we did. And of course, you can find the button to donate to the friendly neighborhood Spider Talk Members Club on both of our homepages.
Mark, where can we find you on the internet?
Yes, well, you can find me at chasingamazingblog.com, which documents my quest to collect every issue of Amazing Spider-Man, down to one, of course. And you can find me on Twitter at chasingasmblog. And you can find some of my other comic book writing on comicbook.com and Comics Should Be Good.
Great. Well, you can follow me on Twitter at Dan Gavazin, or my Spider-Man Twitter account at @SupSpiderTalk, and read all my Spider-Man writing at SuperiorSpiderTalk.com. Mark, I hear there's some whispers on the wind.
Yeah, well, you know, as Captain Stacy once told Gwen, with great podcasts, there must also come Amazing Spider-Talk.